Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The revised GOP health care bill is out and unpopular thus far with New Hampshire's top officials, including Governor Chris Sununu. The Attorney General's office opens a criminal investigation into St. Paul's School. 40 domestic violence cases are refiled in Manchester at the direction of former U.S. Attorney Emily Rice. And it may be summer and a non-election year, but not if you're a voter in State Senate District 16. I am Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, joined this morning by Jeff Feingold, the New Hampshire Business Review, Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Why don't we start with St. Paul's School? Maybe a state investigation was inevitable given the trajectory of the scrutiny there. Associate Attorney General Jane Young told your paper, David, that this could be, quote, a very lengthy process. The initial focus is to be on whether school policy or actions by staff endanger the welfare of children and whether the school may have obstructed justice. Are you surprised by this at all, David?
It wasn't expected, but it is an indication, I think, of a very aggressive posture on the part of the new Attorney General, Mr. McDonald, on investigation and prosecution of sexual assault, sexual abuse cases. Not only have they announced this very aggressive action as regards St. Paul's, they had to intervene in Manchester to assure aggressive prosecution of domestic violence in that city. And I'm very curious to see whether they may decide to look further into the situation at Phillips Exeter Academy in Exeter as well.
Well, one thing that's interesting to me about this is that it is unclear, based on the early reporting, including by us, is how the Attorney General's office came to this conclusion. Obviously, there's lots of news, and there have been, there was the report that St. Paul's commissioned by the Boston law firm of Kasner and Edwards that former Massachusetts Attorney General Scott Harshbarger laid out. That came out earlier this year, and in that report, they found 13 staffers between, I think, 48 and 88, had inappropriate sexual dealings with students. And at that time, the school said, the school failed to protect students from abuse and misconduct done to them by adults entrusted to their care. Since then, there's been, some reporting predominantly in the Concord Monitor about a new game of so-called sexual conquest that the school was dealing with. Boys apparently affixing their names to some kind of crown from Burger King based on their sexual dealings with other students. There's a Chessie Prout lawsuit. She was a victim of Owen Labrie that it's coming next fall. Jeff, do you think that this is something, this Attorney General's report, depending on where this goes, is something that will, create some resolution or just more questions?
Well, it seems to me the impetus for this is this latest game. This was reported, as you said, mostly reported in the Monitor. It was very, very similar, if not, it just had a different name to the one that was involved with the Chessie Prout and Owen Labrie. It's the same kind of thing. And I think that maybe just raised a lot of red flags about really what kind of monitoring is going on here. We've been through this. You know about your history. You know about the history of the culture. And it's still occurring. And I don't know. I have no knowledge if that is exactly what they said, but if that prompted it. But it would seem to me that it would, because you say, wait, what's going on here? You've done your mea culpas and all that, and it's still going on.
Yeah, and I think that's the big difference is, we've talked in recent months about a number of elite boarding schools around the country who have dealt with similar issues. But most of those have been, as you said, kind of mea culpas or penance for a lack of supervision in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, whereas we just got through the Owen LaBrie trial, which is still pending on appeal, and now there's evidence of another round of these kinds of things, and it suggests that the administration there is not really grappling with the problem, and I would be interested to see if there are going to be changes in the, you know, at the administrative level there as well to deal with this.
Well,
I mean, this is going to get tremendous
publicity.
I mean,
the rector, Michael Hirschfeld, his statement was that, you know, that St. Paul's intends to work closely with the Attorney General to answer any and all questions about the independent report that was issued earlier this year. And the goal is will always be the health and safety and well-being of our students, and that, you know, they said they're going to work tirelessly. Obviously, those are the sorts of things you'll say. You know, it'd be interesting to see once, you know, you have the Attorney General, apparently the Merrimack County Attorney's Office is going to be involved, as will the Concord and State Police, if what Attorney General Young, Assistant Attorney General Young, says this could last for a long time.
Yeah, you know, I have to say I was struck by this because something that, that Dave said also is that, you know, 15 years ago or so, we went through the same thing with the Catholic Church, and the result was not really any criminal investigation. It was a civil settlement and all that. And I think in those 15 years, I think it shows how much our attitudes have changed towards this kind of crime. This kind of behavior, you know, and he mentioned, as Dave mentioned, what was going on in Manchester, that it is refreshing just, you know, looking at it, you know, as just a citizen, that, you know, this is taking much more seriously than it had been in 15 years ago, where there was with very, 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 very egregious misconduct on the part of adults. And, you know, it the church itself, the diocese, was just allowed to just kind of, it didn't face any kind of criminal investigation, as St. Paul's is doing.
Well, why don't we listen to what State Rep. Deborah Altshuler told NHPR this morning. You know, she's one of many lawmakers who have called for greater scrutiny.
I'm thrilled. I am. I'm very glad to hear that Attorney General McDonald is taking this seriously, and that the weight of the Attorney General's office will offer a gravity to what's happening over at St. Paul's that it appears that they have not fully embraced.
That's State Rep. Deborah Altshuler of Stratum talking about the gravity that scrutiny from the Attorney General's office will bring. You know, there's obviously going to be a lot of gravity, legal gravity, at St. Paul's over the next, you know, not only this investigation, but the coming civil suit next spring from the Prout family. You know, Dave mentioned another action by the Attorney General's office, and that was involvement and intercession in Manchester over the city solicitor's office failure to fully prosecute sexual assault cases. Obviously, we've had the resignation of Tom Clark. He led that office for 22 years. His deputy, Tom Arnold, I think he'd been with the office for even longer, announced his retirement this week. Former U.S. Attorney Emily Rice is in there. And, you know, David, your paper has been covering every turn of the screw on this. You know, 40 cases are going to be refiled. Is there a sense that there's going to be more to come, or that this were the crucial ones identified by Attorney General McDonald in the report that they issued?
Whether or not additional cases will be reopened remains to be seen. It's hard to imagine there isn't going to be additional fallout from apparently what has been years of dysfunctional prosecution, very ineffective prosecution, at least in domestic violence cases, perhaps sexual assault and other cases we don't know about. It was very, very disturbing for the people in Manchester to learn that their police department had been so frustrated over the years in bringing these cases forward and not seeing them effectively prosecuted, and then having to deal more directly with the people who they had tried so it's so difficult to bring these people to come forward in many of these cases, and then to find them not prosecuted has been extremely distressing. And again, it was a credit to the police department that they brought this forward, and because it oftentimes the prosecution agencies and the police work hand in hand on these things, but in Manchester, that relationship had clearly broken down to the serious disadvantage of the citizens.
Well, one thing that I thought was interesting was that, and perhaps this is what you would do procedurally, but you know, the way that the prosecutor's offices are organized is it's very much you have the municipal, then you have the county, then you have the state, that Police Chief Nick Willard essentially leapfrogged over the county attorney's office, which would have a supervisory role over the city solicitor's office, went right to Attorney General McDonald, who then, you know, took action, and County Attorney Hogan suggested that he was unaware that this was a problem.
I know it does make it's concerning about the communications gap there. It's, you know, what is going on there? Why did they avoid going to the county attorney? I don't understand that myself. It's kind of stood out there. Okay. I just have to say I want something else. I mean, this year there's a mayoral election in Manchester, and this is going to be a major, if not the biggest, the issue.
I think it's likely to be the biggest.
Yeah, and it's really and if you recall, 2 years ago they were separated by a couple of few dozen votes.
I think it was this, 64 votes, yeah, on the recount. That was,
yeah,
it.
And you know, it's Joyce Craig is running again, and I can't imagine it's going to really be a topic of discussion for months to come now, and as Jay said, rightfully so, it's inexplicable that this kind of behavior was done at the city solicitor's office.
All right, tell us what you think. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. You know, the Gatzes Joyce race, you know, I guess they both filed. It is technically on. You know, in the meantime, what some are seeing is a race that will be have implications, you know, in that race in terms of both Democrat and Republican organizing efforts is definitely afoot in District 16. It's sort of creeping up on us. It's going to be, I don't know, in a matter of 10 days or something, this race.
June 25th,
yes,
I think, yeah.
David Booten, who held District 16 seat before retiring, a Republican, versus Kevin Kavanaugh, an alderman, and a guy with a deep roots in the labor community, having been 32 years in a union. You know, this race is getting lots and lots of attention. Not sure what it's like to be a voter in that district, but you know, both sides are trying to gin up participation as much as possible.
Yeah, it's a race that's being watched nationally, actually, and has attracted a lot of national money. I think $100,000. Into both campaigns, a lot of aggressive door-to-door campaigning going on. I would not want to be a candidate trying to get people out to the polls in the third week of July to vote on a special election for state senator. But Dave Booten and Kavanaugh are both working very hard on this race, and it's going to be a very close race. A lot of people think Booten has the inside track because of his long tenure, his name recognition, the very positive brand that's been attached to him for his aggressive work on child protection issues in the state. But Kavanaugh has the same kind of labor support and connections in Manchester, where a lot of the votes are in that district, that enable the Democrat to win when Booten retired.
Yeah, and the special election, I may have said June 25th, it's July 25th, and this is kind of a swingy district. You know, we've talked before about the extent to which national politics have increasingly kind of impeded on state-level politics, and we've seen these state senator positions become increasingly high-profile. Every 2 years, there's more and more money poured into districts where there's a potential to flip a seat either way. We've seen Governor Sununu and former Senator Ayotte cut ads for Booten. I think Martin O'Malley is going to come in and campaign, the former Maryland governor.
When
you have a special election, it's really sort of, you're not going to get the casual voter. So you want to focus on turning out your core partisan. So there may be O'Malley supporters or core Democrats who will be happy to have him in the district. But it is amazing the extent to which these state races, particularly the state Senate now, just draw a lot of attention and a lot of money.
Yeah, actually, there was an email was sent out by someone from the state Democratic Party in New Hampshire crowing about some race in Oklahoma, you know, a state Senate race, you know, that was because it flipped over to the Democrats or something.
Digital technology and fundraising and campaign finance decisions have just nationalized everything.
Yeah, and also, it had been said that part of the problem with the Democratic Party is that for many years it didn't focus on state and local races, and that's why they've been at a great disadvantage when it comes to every 10 years with the census, because they don't have these legislatures. They don't have majorities in the legislatures, and that affects them long term on the national level. So I guess now they're really realize, whoops, we've been sleep at the switch on this, so let's start focusing on these state races.
David mentioned, I mean, this is a race that has gotten a lot of attention, and it is one, as you mentioned, it is actually, I mean, you could argue that it is the most swing district in the state Senate, certainly among them. You know, you have two candidates who have bases of support. I mean, David Booten, when he first got elected to the seat, it was actually in a special election, and I can recall covering that race largely to see how then new candidate Kelly Ayotte would do out on the campaign trail. And I can recall campaigning once with them with just wannabe Senator Kelly Ayotte, wannabe State Senator David Booten, and me walking through, you know, a cul-de-sac-ish sort of neighborhood in Hooksett. And, you know, it was interesting, just the positive response going door to door that that Kelly Ayotte got was what I recall most on that day. But certainly David Booten, you know, well known in the community, and I agree with David that he's built up a solid sort of brand around his work regarding DCYF. I do note that he has a Twitter handle that identifies himself as a retired senator, which he might want to refresh lest he give people the wrong impression. But
put a question mark on the end of it.
But that race is going to be interesting to watch. Also, just as a precursor to the mayor's race, in terms of both sides as a dress rehearsal to get out voters.
Yes, because July 25th, that is definitely a test of your organization, and that's one way where Kevin Kavanaugh's union backing has might come into play on this.
And that was certainly something that helped former Senator Scott McGillivray, who died in office, and that's why we're having this special election, his ties to organized labor.
Well, this might be great for people who are trying to read tea leaves on the off-year election in 18. It's not really going to have much effect on the New Hampshire Senate, no matter what the outcome is, because the best case the Democrats can hope for is it gets their minority up to 10, and the Republicans could pick up an extra one on their side.
And, as we saw the way the Senate votes tended to go this session, Senate President Chuck Morse, he joked about it when the budget debate was ending that, he doesn't tolerate kind of dissonant caucuses within the GOP in the Senate. And, he's done a pretty good job of running a tight ship there. So I think David's point is well taken, but that's not going to dull the ardor of at least like hardcore people, for the next 10 days.
Other.
All right. Tell us what you think. This is the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. That race is heating up, and we're going to get to, after the break, a discussion of the congressional races, where we're actually starting to see some movement there, particularly positioning on the Republican side. In both CD1 and CD2, and also a town hall meeting from Annie McLean Custer, who, per reporting in the Union Leader, also issued some, from WMUR, also released, more fundraising numbers that suggests that her aptitude at extracting cash from her supporters has not faded. Stick around. We'll be right back after a short break. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be right back.
A young man and woman fall in love while traveling across Europe in Joseph Monninger's new novel, but he says making that seem interesting on the page is not that easy.
Being in love isn't really that interesting. It's the before and after that really kind of brings the impact.
I'm Peter Biello. Joseph Monninger and I speak about his new book and writing about love on The Bookshelf from NHPR. Find this and all of NHPR's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477 or email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, David Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review. I mentioned it coming out of into the break that, like it or not, we talk about the special election and we talk about all the vast amount of time or seemingly vast amount of time between now and 2018. But there does appear to be efforts to position oneself on the for the congressional races, particularly on the GOP side, candidates for both first and second districts, Andy Sanborn and Eddie Edwards in CD1 and Jack Flanagan in CD2, joined anti-tax activist Grover Norquist in Manchester this week. They all signed the Americans for Tax Reform pledge to oppose new or increased taxes. And Grover Norquist himself, took the opportunity to push for cuts to corporate tax rates. Why don't we listen?
We're the number one taxer of corporate income at 35%. Japan used to be stupider at 40, and they decided to pass on that. Now we're stupidest. Stupider than France is not where you want to be on taxation. European average, about 22%. Ireland's at 12.5. We're at 35.
All right. That was Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform talking about corporate tax rates. You know, Dean, tax reform is something that Republicans have been talking about for a long time, something that they think that they might be able to reach across the aisle on. President Trump has talked about it. The question of, can it be done in the current political atmosphere? Can it be done with, distractions du jour? Can it be done in the wake of whatever happens with healthcare?
Right. Well, and that's the question. You know, I think a best case scenario for Republicans in Congress would be to get the health care reform through the summer and then focus on tax reform going into the fall. I don't know that that's going to happen. We'll talk about the health care bill in a moment. But the tax reform, I think, is still in its formative stages. It's going to be pretty controversial, is my guess. It's interesting. You know, this you mentioned that these candidates all signed the pledge that this American for Tax Reform puts out, and that is Grover Norquist's pledge. There was a time where failure to sign that particular pledge as a Republican congressperson was really kind of a kiss of death to your campaign. The electoral environment is a lot more cluttered now. I don't know that it carries quite the same weight, but, clearly he's up here, and Bill O'Brien's right-of-center organization had him in. So we'll see. I mean, it's a big issue. This tax reform is a big issue to Republicans, both to help the middle class, but also to deal with they believe the corporate tax rates are that the key to kind of spurring faster economic growth than we're currently experiencing would be a significant cut in corporate tax rates. And then there's some debate about whether or not they'd be able to help the middle class, or they would just sort of change the tax bracket for upper income individuals.
I have to say, to answer your question, whether it's going to be done, is the answer is no. Because, if you think healthcare legislation is hard, this is the hardest thing, because healthcare just has a few industries involved in lobbying. But if it's tax reform, we're talking about every possible industry involved. Every lobbyist in Washington will be involved in this. And the window that the Republicans had to do this was pretty large when it was January 20th. But it's shrinking more and more, as we know. When it came to the health law proposal, it's Senate Majority Leader McConnell had to extend the window to cut off 2 weeks of the recess and all that stuff. And once you get into 2018 in an election year, it won't happen. It's too volatile an issue for it to happen.
I mean, just on policy grounds. I mean, is this something from talking to businesses that they really want or think would actually be terrifically beneficial to them or not?
I think they like the general idea of this, But as I said, the specifics are what's important. Yeah. And you know, when you talk about just bringing down the tax rates, oh, that sounds great. But how are we bringing down the tax rates? You know, what's going to be taxed? What kind of tax breaks, deductions are going to be eliminated, because that would be part of the deal. And that would set off that sets off a whole
cascade.
Chain. Yeah, absolutely.
And electorally, timing is important here. If you talk to conservatives, you know, the sort of supply side, or trickle down, if you prefer, theory says that if you significantly lower corporate income tax rates and other tax rates, that spurs innovation and investment, and that creates more jobs. And a lot of those folks like to point back to Ronald Reagan's run for re-election, and their argument is that, you know, he had these tax cuts in '83, and so the economy was speeding just as he ran for re-election, and he had a landslide. So in their mind, they want to kind of replicate tax cut 17, booming economy in 18. But I think you're pointing out that's a very tall order at this
very
point.
Very tall. And the economy has changed dramatically in those 30 years also. The economy is much different.
The politics have changed dramatically. It's amazing they were able to get a major tax reform package through in 86, and it was done on a bipartisan basis. And historically— The history of the country shows that big bills like this, in order for them to pass and stick, have to be done on a bipartisan basis. Obamacare has been a subject of debate for 7 years because it was passed by one party. And we cannot have these major issues like tax structure and health care be subject to reversal every time a different party takes power. So there's a need for bipartisan consensus that is lacking. So I agree with Jeff. Not only is the meter running out, but the ability to craft a bipartisan approach to these problems seems to be more remote than ever.
Well, add to that immigration. I spent part of the week out at a town hall meeting with Congresswoman Custer, and it was interesting to watch her in action. She threw it open to questions. The first question was over her support for some GOP-backed bills regarding immigration, most specifically so-called Kate's Law, which was a bill inspired by the murder of California woman Kate Steinle by a serially deported man who had committed numerous felonies. You know, horrible crime. This bill would stiffen penalties in those sorts of circumstances, but would also tighten penalties for people who were serially deported and attempt to come back even if they don't have a criminal record. And why don't we listen to a little bit of a back and forth between Margaret Wheeler, the first person speaking, then Congresswoman Custer.
This city is full of people that won't leave their homes because they're afraid of being deported and never being able to come back. They're hiding in their homes. Right.
So I am opposed to what the Trump administration ran on and what they're doing to discourage people from staying here. And I want to just balance welcoming people and keeping the community safe.
All right, that was Congresswoman Annie Custer interacting with a voter during a town hall meeting in Nashua. You know, Custer was one of just 24 Democrats in the House to back this Kate's Law bill. She was one of about 50 Democrats to back a separate bill to reduce some standards for hiring of Border Patrol agents. Both votes have, won her the attention and some frustration of, some liberal activist groups. And she received in her last campaign $5,000 from the PAC, from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Those folks are not necessarily pleased by these votes. Does it surprise any of you that Custer would be kind of out there on the other side of many on her caucus? Carol Shea Porter voted on the opposite side of these bills. Does it surprise you at all, Dean?
No. I think it's a recognition that even though the 2nd Congressional District has trended Democratic in recent years, particularly in Concord and, along the Upper Valley, Hanover, down to Keene, that the district is still mixed. It was held for many years by Charlie Bass, a well-known Republican, over a decade, I believe. And so this is one of those things where, you take a lot of votes in Congress and other campaigns will kind of pick and choose what they want to throw at you. And I think it was sort of a recognition that she needs to kind of strike a balance here in her mind in order to remain competitive in that district and not give Republicans easy fodder for campaign ads.
Well, that's one thing she told me. And then she also said this, which I think was interesting. Why don't we play the tape of what she said about why people ultimately shouldn't be too concerned about these votes?
They're not going anywhere. They're not going to be taken up in the Senate. They're not, none of these things are going to happen.
All right, that was Custer, more frank than a lot of politicians are about
throwaway votes.
I was surprised when that was the most candid admission of a pure political calculation that I'd heard in a long time. I'm voting for this. I kind of don't really agree with it, but it's not really going to happen anyway, and it's just a trap the Republicans are setting up for us to so they have.
I think it really shows that these votes show that she's not concerned that she's going to get any challenges in a primary next year from a Democrat who's more progressive, but she is concerned about running in the general election, that she's thinking about the general election. And you know, she had a tougher race last time around.
Pretty much anyone expected.
Yeah,
and obviously
much
it was
tougher.
A presidential year, yes. And certainly if you look at the second congressional district, that was an area where Donald Trump really did exceed expectations in rural areas in Sullivan and Coos County, Grafton County.
Yeah. And just politically speaking, I'm not justifying the vote or criticizing it, but I'm just saying that just politically speaking, she's thinking that way, that she wants to be prepared for November, as opposed to thinking, well, I have to worry about the Democratic base, when I assume she's calculated that she doesn't have to worry.
Yeah,
about
and I mean that's a time-honored tradition of legislators kind of looking for voting minefields and trying to sort of game out whether or not if I vote this way, it's going to come back to haunt me. And hey, it looks like the bill's not going anywhere anyway. So why step into that trap?
Yeah.
Well, and she did reiterate several times to me that what she's really hoping for is comprehensive immigration reform, is how she put it. And she said that she believed that was more doable than a lot of people think, but that would require actually bringing a bill to the floor, which is not like
the track.
And it would also, to Dave's point earlier about bipartisanship, that would require in spades. So we'll see if that can happen.
Well, and in the meantime, Congresswoman Custer continues to raise a lot of money. A report from WMUR this week showed that she raised $465,000 between April and June, $850,000 for the year. So that puts her at $1.67 million on hand, according to the reporting of John DeStaso. And, that's a lot of money and, more to come, presumably. And we're still, well out from the election. And in her lone opponent, Republican Jack Flanagan, this is somebody who couldn't get through the primary last time, had a hard time raising money, and we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but it's not necessarily looking like the sort of Trump coattails that boosted Jim Lawrence are going to be.
If you look at the midterm elections are definitely there's always a flip in from the Democrats that party out of the White House has a much better chance of gaining seats in the Congress. And I assume that right now both Congresswoman Porter and Custer Shea Porter and Custer are pretty much comfortable where they are right now.
Well, and even last time, I remember Congresswoman Custer had quite a war chest to go up against Lawrence, $4 or $5 million on hand, something like that.
And that was, and also, and 2016 was a very strange election year, and things have changed pretty radically in the last few months in terms of perceptions of what can happen in Washington.
Well, and those perceptions right now, and the warring perceptions on a partisan basis, are certainly at play as we continue to, sort of untangle how New Hampshire and how other states are going to comply or not comply with the president's voter fraud / election integrity commission. The potential sharing of New Hampshire voter information was put on hold this week pending the outcome of a federal lawsuit, and that's apart from a separate suit here brought by the ACLU with lead plaintiff Republican lawmaker Neil Kirk over whether New Hampshire's law contemplates sharing voter information as envisioned by this commission, which would be public information shareable. New Hampshire's law specifies it can go to parties or political committees. Governor Sununu is for sharing that info. He says it's a way to put to rest questions of voter frauds, a position that Bill Gardner has also articulated. The governor joined the exchange this week on Monday. And why don't we listen to what he said on voter fraud? And this was this Monday.
Do we have voter fraud or don't? I've always said we have no evidence of voter fraud in this state. We have none. I've never seen a bit of actual evidence of it. Are we going to put this debate to rest one way or the other? Well, the only way to do that is to look at whether it's really there or not. I suspect even if it's there, it's pretty minimal.
All right, that was Governor Chris Sununu this week on the exchange. you know, as he said, I've always said there's no voter fraud in New Hampshire. I mean, in colleague Casey McDermott did a nice write-up of the governor's various statements on this since last year. Last October, he said there's no doubt that there's election fraud here. It kind of depends on the venue with him when he appears on Boston Talk Radio.
Right.
Tends to bring out kind of an id on this topic. north of the border, particularly here, he tends to be a little bit more circumspect. What do you make of his?
I think his position has evolved as this has gone from a hot talk show topic generated by wild accusations from the president to a real issue of local impact in which voters of New Hampshire in significant numbers are expressing concerns about the release of this information. And he's kind of adjusting his opinion to the reality on the ground. We're not just talking about this in the abstract now, but in terms of the release of these data files that have drawn a lot of public opposition. One of the most disturbing reports I've heard on this is that people are going into town halls and asking to have their names taken off the rolls. They would rather not be registered to vote than worry about having their information shared with the federal government in this way. So it's not surprising that the governor would moderate his position from one in which election fraud is a problem in New Hampshire. They're bussing people in from Massachusetts to the present version, which is we have no record of fraud, but we need to dispel this notion that it exists.
And it's not just the Democrats who are doing this. It's Republicans as well and independents who are voicing frustration about this whole idea that they would just so willingly give up these records without even considering what the legal ramifications would be, you know, because there have been I've read many legal analyses of this saying that the law says you cannot do this, you cannot share this information because it says it's only for political parties and for that kind of purpose.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jeff. No, I was just going to say opposition to this, as you mentioned, cuts across, you know, Democratic, Libertarian, states' rights, conservatives here mm-hmm. in New Hampshire. And Josh, I'm glad you called out the governor as trying to slip the always in there because we've all heard the comments, particularly on the Boston Talk Radio, about Democrats being bussed into the state. And he, as Dave said, he has kind of changed his position over time. You know, I've been very outspoken on this. I believe that if their goal is, as Governor Sununu says and as Secretary of State Gardner says, is to put to rest voter concerns about the integrity of the system, this commission is not the way to accomplish
right.
it.
Well, when you see the and also when you see the makeup of the commission, it does raise the yeah. concerns.
There is a strain of thought among progressives that this sort of chaos that has resulted from this was intentional. That, you know, Chris Kobach from Oklahoma, he's an experienced Secretary of State. He knew he was poking a hornet's nest with this. You know, we'll see. That's one school of thought in the party, but nonetheless, I think there's sort of broader opposition on privacy grounds.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and that commission was supposed to have its first meeting
July 19th.
Yes, and you know, pending the lawsuit, the information. But, you know, certainly Secretary of State Gardner, you know, he's been of the mind that absent sharing that information, you know, the people who are inclined to believe there's a voter fraud and irregularities in our election are going to be emboldened, is the term he uses. And I'm not entirely sure what he means. Is that simply just a decay in the faith of our electoral system, or, you know, emboldened to, you know, make a run on the New Hampshire primary, which is obviously always in the back of the Secretary of State's mind, you know.
Yeah, have the buses fired up or something.
Well, the key thing to watch for is going to be whether the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia rules in favor of the request for an injunction to stop the data gathering while the merits of the case are argued in a more lengthy proceeding. Because if that injunction is granted, it indicates that the judge thinks that the plaintiffs have a pretty good chance of prevailing.
The electronic privacy organization.
The electronic privacy organization has a good chance of winning. So we're watching that carefully.
All right, stick around. More Grand State headlines on the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR after a short break.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is the week of the New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or by email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Twitter or Facebook. Joined this week by Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review, David Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spilliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. You know, we're talking about the governor in light of this election fraud commission that's chaired by Mike Pence. The governor and Mike Pence and many other governors are together right now in Providence. It's the summer meeting of the National Governors Association. It's quite a cast of characters there. We have Mike Pence. We have Tom Price, Health and Human Services Secretary. We have Justin Trudeau, Elon Musk. Health care is a major topic at this meeting. Obviously, the new Senate bill is out. If this was supposed to galvanize support, there's little indication that that is happening thus far. It keeps some of the taxes that fund so-called Obamacare. It does loosen some policies regarding what sort of policies insurers can write, among other things. Why don't we listen to what Governor Sununu said about this issue on CNBC this morning?
You know, one thing that I think a lot of people miss in this conversation is they're looking at reforming Obamacare, which is critical, and basic Medicaid entitlement reform, kind of pre-2008 type stuff. So when you put those two things together, I think they're really conflating two separate issues. My argument is to take them separately. Look at Obamacare reform, look at entitlement reform. Both of those have to have long, substantial arguments and bring them to the floor of both the House and the Senate. But when you put them both together, the cost implications are huge to a state like New Hampshire.
All right. That was Governor Sununu this morning. Once long arguments on both entitlement reform and reform of Obamacare. Sounds like he doesn't want anything to happen too fast.
It's interesting that he used the word reform instead of repeal. Yeah. That's kind of a moderating of the position. And this notion that you can unhook the future of Medicare from healthcare reform writ large is somewhat unrealistic because it's a centerpiece of the Obamacare legislation. How do you ensure more people? You expand Medicare so it embraces the next level of income, and it's going to be very hard to approach that separately. And the fact that the most recent version of the bill is now opposed by one senator who's extremely to the right, Rand Paul, and another one who's more moderate, Susan Collins from Maine, suggests that they haven't done a very good job of crafting a compromise that's going to win over a large enough faction that has been standing in opposition. But that remains to be seen. We could see a recurrence of some of the same logic that prevailed in the New Hampshire legislature that got a budget passed, where the leadership said to the reluctant members of the Republican Party, if you don't stand with us on this, we're going to have to negotiate with the Democrats on something, and our base is going to be very angry. So in the end, that argument could prevail, that it's better for us to pass an unpopular bill as Republicans than to face the wrath of our constituents should we do nothing.
I think the problem is for Governor Sununu and many other governors this weekend in Rhode Island is that bill, this bill, this latest version is no different really when it comes to treatment of Medicaid, which is really which is a key thing for states like New Hampshire, which agreed to expand Medicaid and has been, by almost all accounts, has been a successful expansion of health care access to thousands of people. And it's multiplied all across the country. And that's where Senator Collins in Maine basically is looking at it and said, this is not sustainable. And I do think that what's going to happen is that Vice President Pence is going to get an earful from a lot of governors where they have gone through Medicaid expansion. There's Ohio, there's Kentucky, actually, and there's Nevada, where there are Republican governors who have really worked hard to do this stuff. And I think that they are concerned about what the effect would be on the state. I mean, it's like pulling the rug out because the long term is to cut Medicaid funding by something like 30%, which would really decimate the program.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jeff. I think for all the discussion about the exchanges and propping up mm-hmm. the exchanges, in the end, this is coming down to a debate about the future of Medicaid, yes. and these cuts are all still in there. It's like $800 million. It's $800 billion. It's almost $1 trillion yes. over 10 years. And Dave raised an interesting point. I saw Governor Sununu last night on cable TV making similar arguments, and he was kind of switching back and forth between repeal and reform, and I wasn't clear sort of what he was advocating, because
I think that's in real time his thought process.
And that's an issue, because I did an interview with Governor Hassan last week, and you can find the link to the audio on nhpoliticalcapital.com. And we pushed her, and she was very clear that as long as the concept of repeal is included in the package, Democrats are not likely to come to the table. So if Governor Sununu using the word reform is in some way going to take them down a different path, then Democrats might be open to negotiating. But I think in the end, this is going to come down to, as you mentioned, places like Ohio with Senator Rob Portman, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, although we're now seeing that the bill has some special formula in there that kicks a lot of additional funds just to
Alaska.
Just to Alaska. And so she's actually a little sort of aware of that, and I'm not sure that's going to tip the balance.
And why
for
they didn't
her,
send it to
right?
Maine, too? I don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah, so I think it's going to come down to a discussion about how many people are going to lose Medicaid coverage.
Yes. Well, certainly there is that, but I mean, maybe that's where the debate is heading, but in the near term, certainly propping up the exchanges is also something
yes.
that has been a stated concern and a real yeah. one for Governor Sununu and New Hampshire. I mean, we're still, rates are going to be coming out. We have, we're going to have fewer carriers, at least in the near term, and fewer policy options. But absent some sort of premium, support mechanism, those rates are going to really spike.
Yes, and that's a major concern, obviously, to the governor and to obviously anyone who's on the exchange. The real concern, though, is that if this does fail, this latest version, will the Republicans work with Democrats in Congress to find some way to help bolster those exchanges, at least for an interim period, while they move on, because that is a concern.
Well, it's going to come down to a political calculation. I mean, it's highly speculative. We're talking about what would happen if the bill failed, but they'll then be faced with a decision. Do we prop up these exchanges, at least by making the risk adjustment payments to the insurance companies that are promised in the law, or do we construct an environment in which the insurance system collapses, which I don't think would serve anyone's interest.
Yeah, I think that would.
Well, how do you time that also?
But if you look at it as a political calculation, if there are people who are seriously thinking about, well, we'll just let the whole thing collapse and we'll worry about it, I think that's a government shutdown to an exponential level that I think people would never forget.
Well, before Governor Sununu headed off to his meeting in Rhode Island, where they're grappling with these topics, international trade, opioids. There were also kind of breakout sessions on. They were going to get some people from RISD in to talk about, applying design theory to governing. And I think Frank Luntz was doing a presentation to chiefs of staff about how to craft a winning narrative for a legacy building. And there was also going to be a clam bake and a fireworks show. Sounded like a festive meeting. But before the governor headed off to that, he did, sign kindergarten and an event at Penacook Elementary. I was in attendance. This was something that, he clearly sees as part of his legacy. He's already issued a video talking about this bill. He also, issued his first veto, which was on a far less high-profile measure having to do with variances. And he issued the veto. He ultimately issued the veto message when people started asking about it. But at first, it was just as a footnote
yes.
to a long list of bills that he had signed. And, I know your paper wrote about this a little bit. Is this significant, this veto? It's hard for me to tell.
It was one of these definitely a low-profile bill that was passed pretty easily
in
both houses. Absolutely.
Both.
And what happened was, what the bill is, local zoning boards, there's a state requirement that they have to look at five different factors before approving a zoning variance. And many boards vote individually on each one of these factors, but some boards vote as one big chunk, saying, well, do they meet all five? Let's vote. Okay, yes, they do, as opposed to voting on each one. So this bill would have said, no, you have to vote on each one individually. what happened was that I guess the municipal association, people like that, they were in favor of this. But the realtors and the New Hampshire Association of Realtors were very vocal in their opposition. Surprisingly enough, the home builders were kind of neutral on this bill, but apparently the realtors got the governor's ear, and convinced him that he needed to veto this bill. And the interesting thing was, at least for where I could tell, the realtors were out with a statement almost immediately before the governor's veto message became public, which was interesting by itself. But it's an obscure thing, and how it affects development, I'm not sure. The realtors said it would.
Certainly, if you've got a big town and if you had to take multiple votes like, on each one, it could add up to many votes.
Because some developments are more than just one vote.
I spoke with the sponsor of the bill, Jim Belanger, a representative from Hollis, and he said that this was something that, in his mind, would streamline. And he said that he's going to bring this bill back. If they can't override, he thinks they might build override. And since it was actually passed by both House and Senate, they can bring it right back. And so we're going to renew this.
The one
debate.
Thing is that the developers, I think, really want to know when you go into a town, is it going to be the same process in Hollis as it is in Plastow? And that's really what
it
was.
Consistency. Yeah. That's why they supported it. But it's hard for me to understand how requiring zoning boards to take 5 separate votes on each variance request instead of 1 streamlines the process in any way.
And that was the governor's argument.
Well, and also he had sort of a local control take on it that, in some towns that's what they want to do. In other towns, that's not.
Yes. I mean, this is might have been a small issue at the State House, but if you've ever covered towns, as a town reporter, the hottest place to be is the zoning board,
where
people go in and ask to do something with their property that's not consistent with the zoning. And one of the most popular requests is to subdivide another house lot that's just not quite the proper size, but very close. So this ability to create additional sublots is viewed as desirable by the realtors. I think the builders will like it, but I think, as Jeff said, they just want consistency so they don't go to one town and 5 votes, and the next town it's 1 vote.
Exactly.
They'll still have to live with that.
Well, the zoning board can be a hot place to be. Agreed there. A hot place to be this weekend is going to be at the Sunapee Historical Society's Aerosmith History Day event. That's going to be going on this weekend. And, NHPR spoke with Jonathan Robinson. He's hoping to organize the event. Why don't we take a listen to what he told Rick Gandler this morning?
So I started collecting a lot of archives in the band, everything that was printed and all the great rock magazines of the time, Circus and Hit Parader, Cream Magazine. And it just developed and grew over the years to the point now where it's inarguably the largest collection of its kind in the world. Some 54 years of clippings and articles, interviews, magazine covers. If you put it all on a bulletin board, it's over 3 football fields long.
All right, 300 yards of Aerosmith memorabilia on display at the Sunapee Historical Society. That was Jonathan Robinson. And, certainly... If you're sort of driving aimlessly, spinning the FM dial, it does seem like Aerosmith is readily at hand.
Yes.
Despite their low pay.
Part of the lore there is that Steve Tyler and Joe Perry met at Sunapee summer. Yeah.
I mean, you could talk about randomly, dialing in Aerosmith's ubiquitous on the FM dial. Aerosmith is ubiquitous certainly in Sunapee, in the Sunapee region where I live, and it's pretty close. They're pretty close to a deity in that area. And
if you take a summer boat tour, the guides point out the various vacation homes of the different members.
They do. And there's always occasional Steve Tyler sightings, I saw him over at the Flying Goose or whatever. And
this is often cited at the music store in downtown Dover as well.
When I was a junior in junior high school here in Concord, my recollection is a long time ago. Aerosmith was kind of relaunching after a fallow and kind of drugged out period. It was kind of pre their relaunch when they did Walk This Way with Run DMC, and they did a concert at whatever the precursor to the Capitol Center. I forget what it used to be called, but There was a concert, and I remember, you know, the Monitor did a big article, but that the kids ditched from Runlet Junior High, where I was a student, from Concord High. The place to buy your tickets was at Pitchfork Records, which was where Bagel Works is now, if you're familiar with Concord's Main Street. And, you know, this was one of the first kind of tribal rock and roll moments, like, I can recall in my own life. I'm not a huge Aerosmith fan, but this drew, you know, droves and droves of teenagers downtown. And, you know, we were discussing in the newsroom yesterday, you know, whether or not New Hampshire makes too much of its connection to Aerosmith. And you know, it's a very New Hampshire thing to do. And so we looked at the Concord Monitor did a book, It's New Hampshire Century. It featured an interview with Steven Tyler, and he talks about his connection to Sunapee. He said, quote, "It's where we smoked our first joints. It's where I had sex with my first girlfriend. All the firsts," talking about Sunapee. all the Aerosmith memorabilia is going to be on display this weekend. No indication whether Steven Tyler or any other member of the band may be on hand, but, you know, speculation is, could be.
Yes. Yes, that's what they're hoping for. Trust me. And actually, when you think about this idea, you wonder why they haven't had this kind of, any kind of a display just permanently in Sunapee to attract people into the harbor, which wouldn't be such a bad thing.
All right. It is the middle of the summer. We're getting ready for the Aerosmith exhibit. You know, in the meantime, what are people looking towards next week, David?
Everyone's going to be watching the fate of the latest iteration of the Republican House, the bill in the Senate, and our Governor Sununu's continued prominence on the national stage, as Governor frequently sought out now for national press interviews, given his status as a Republican who's kind of on the fence in this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the vote supposedly going to be held sometime in the coming week, and we'll see what happens, or if there won't be one, if they're going to be continuing to work on this thing. It just seems like as if there were, the deck is stacked against it, but we have, as Dave said, we have two senators who are already against it, and there's going to be looking for that third, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Dean?
Yeah, those are the issues. What comes out of the governor's meetings, the health care bill, and what happens with these requests for injunctions on the voter integrity data.
And if you are interested in the District 16 special election in the state Senate, want to let you know that Kevin Cavanaugh, David Booten, and Libertarian Jason Dubrow will be on the exchange Tuesday for debate. So if you live in that district, want to learn more, or just curious, tune in. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I am Josh Rogers. Thank you to all. Have a good weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.